Welcome to season 9 of Witchlit, now a monthly podcast. We're still in conversation with authors of the occult, but we have transitioned to doing our seasonal special episodes every month, mostly so I have more time to write more books. I'm excited to bring back previous guests via Hedera, Charles Harrington, and Kata Kiss, and we have some wonderful new guests scheduled, including Aidan Wachter, Judica Illis, and Cassandra Snow. If you'd like to read along with us in book club fashion, I'll announce the next month's read on the previous month's episode. So for May, Via Hedera will be joining me to talk about Lillian Morrison's 1958 book, Touch Blue, a folklore collection for children. It's tricky to find a hard copy, but Open Library has it to borrow. Let's jump in to this month's discussion with Ron Padrone. Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. So welcome to the new version of Witchlit for now. So we're doing episodes that are more like our special episodes in the past. So I have guests with me today to talk about a book that they chose. So I'm going to tell you about the author of that book and the book, and then we'll jump in from there.
Gloria E. Anzaldúa, born September 26, 1942, was an American scholar of Chicana feminism, cultural theory, and queer theory.
She loosely based her best-known book, Borderlands, La Frontera, The New Mestiza, on her life growing up on the Mexico-Texas border, and incorporated her lifelong experiences of social and cultural She loosely based her best-known book, Borderlands, La Frontera, The New Mestiza, on her life growing up on the Mexico-Texas border, and incorporated her lifelong experiences of social and cultural marginalization into her work. She also developed theories about the marginal, in-between, and mixed cultures that developed along borders, including on the concepts of Nepantla, Hoyoshalki, imperative, new tribalism, and spiritual activism. Her other notable publications include the co-edited This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color. So we're going to talk about Light in the Dark, Luz en lo Oscuro, Rewriting Identity, Spirituality, and Reality. And I'm apologizing now and probably will throughout the episode for my bad Spanish and Nahuatl pronunciations. Anzaldúa wrote Light in the Dark during the last decade of her life and published in 2015. Drawn from her unfinished dissertation for her PhD in literature from the University of California, Santa Cruz, the book is carefully organized from the Gloria Anzaldúa papers by Ana Louise Keating, Anzaldúa's literary trustee. The book represents her most developed philosophy. Throughout Light in the Dark, Anzaldúa weaves personal narratives into deeply engaging theoretical reading to comment on numerous contemporary issues, including the September 11 attack, neocolonial practices in the art world, and coalitional politics. She valorizes subaltern forms and methods of knowing, being, and creating that have been marginalized by Western thought, and theorizes her writing process as a fully embodied artistic, spiritual, and political practice. Light in the Dark contains multiple transformative theories, including Nepantlera's, the Coyoshalki imperative, named for the Aztec goddess Coyoshalki of the moon, spiritual activism, and others. Both of these sections were from Wikipedia, and there's definitely more about her there. But the person that has chose the book and is on with me today to talk about it is the Reverend Ron Padrone, and I'm going to have him introduce himself, and his Spanish pronunciation is better than mine, so you won't have to suffer as much.
We'll see. No pressure. Hi. So my name is Ron Padrone, Reverend Ron Padrone, he and pronouns, and I am a gay, disabled Cuban American hedge priest, and I am the creator behind White Rose Witching. White Rose Witching is the vehicle that I use for my my pagan ministry, so queer affirming, queer centered ministry, but also for the spiritual activism work that I do more broadly and the sort of deep dives into the pagan theology, specifically liberation theology through a pagan lens. And it's also where you can find the work that I'm involved in, including co-editing a zine with some friends that I co-founded and co-edited a zine called Alter Punk with some friends, which is an interfaith zine that is designed to reclaim the idea of religiosity and spiritualism, spirituality from the far right, from nationalist movements, because they're not the only ones who get to be spiritual or their motivating force in the world for progress to be spiritually driven. And also I started a new zine project there called the Pagan Punk Community Grimoire, which is a community-based, community-grown marriage of the idea of the grimoire as a magical collection of formula, rituals, recipes, what have you, in a zine, being a community-generated, community-driven, community-focused, knowledge-sharing platform. And it's just a growing collection of 1 to 2 page mini zines, each one about a specific topic. I've written some friends have written some. I have more that I need to post. I'm just behind. And I'm very, 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 very excited to talk about this book because Gloria Anzaldúa's writings and this book specifically had a really, really, really big impact on why I decided to pursue pagan ministry and also how my idea of spiritual activism has formed over the last 3 years.
That kind of answers kind of what I was going to ask you first about, like, why particularly this book? Like, what about this book and in her canon even? Why did you choose this one?
Yeah, so I want to say 2020, I was doing a lot of reflecting. I was connecting with a lot of folks. It's when I had started to kind of re-engage my spiritual practice in the couple of years leading up to that. And then when, you know, in the States, when we found ourselves in like a lockdown, I had a lot of time to think. And I don't know that I ever fully really heard the term spiritual activism before. So I was chatting with a friend of mine who is a longtime trans activist, LGBTQ plus activist, does a lot of sort of interfaith coalition building. And they had introduced me first to another book by, I'm blanking on who the author is, but the book is called Activist Theology. And so I read that book, and it was a more sort of like Christian-centered, but like progressive Christian-centered book, but it was still really accessible, really interesting. And that started my sort of journey to really piecing together or connecting that, like, a lot of what drives me in my social justice work that I do, both personally and professionally, it feels like a calling. It feels like sort of a spiritual calling to do that work. They then recommended this book to me, this Gloria Anzaldúa book, and which ended up turning into the basis for a presentation that we both did together at the Salem Witchcraft and Folklore Festival, I think in 2021. It was about spiritual activism, dreaming different worlds. And yeah, just like from the get-go, so I'm first generation Cuban American. My mom was born in Cuba. She came here with her parents when she was really young. They were refugees. My dad is American, but I grew up almost exclusively with my mom's side of the family. And so between that, being queer, being disabled, like all these identities and stuff like that I've found out about myself or gained over the course of my lifetime, there was just something super accessible about Gloria Anzaldúa writing from this, in this book specifically, this position of this intersection between being somebody who has multiple identities that exist on a margin, but also how that informs the ability to engage with spirituality, art, reality, social structures, mm-hmm. whatever that might be, in a more fluid way. And so that just, again, like it just so spoke to me and became so foundational to the work that I do with White Rose Witching, how I approach specifically working with folks with marginalized identities, possibly multiple marginalized identities, that, when we connected and you're like, oh, is there a particular book that you want to talk about? I glanced over, I was like, oh man, I don't know what book. And I glanced over at my bookshelf and like immediately the first one that I saw was this one. And I was like, it absolutely has to be this book. It absolutely has to be Light of the Dark.
We talked a little bit before, as listeners know. And when you suggested the book, I was like, I went and looked. I was like, oh, this sounds great. And then I kind of got nervous when I got it because I was like, my brain is mush right now. Can I read an academic book and get anything out of it? And then I started reading it. And though the editor's introduction is kind of academic, like once you get into Anzaldúa's writing, I mean, it's deep and thoughtful, but it does not sound like academic writing. it's just someone talking to you about her life. And she even talks about that in the book, about how the way she wrote was a problem when she tried to do her PhD the first time, that there was so much pushback about her personalizing her work. And I mean, what is your take on that kind of and like how she approaches this?
So I think so. So I have a lot of experience in academia, and I consider myself a non-academic academic. There's a journal that I helped to co-found, a disability journal. And I specifically said, I was like, part of this has to be a space for personal essays, poetry, reflective pieces for people who aren't researchers. Because with the disabled community specifically, a lot of the ways that that community that we get written about is we're written about, or we're medicalized or a research subject, and we very rarely get to have our own voices. So that to me is, you know, part of the reason that I love writers and activists and intellectuals and philosophers like Gloria Anzaldúa, who make their writing accessible, but also unapologetic. Because, and we talked, when we talked about this before, I said, her writing is accessible with like a little caveat where structurally she flows between English and Spanish, like even within the same sentence. So if, as somebody who grew up around Spanish, but is used to reading primarily in English, it was still a little bit jarring to kind of open up a book and see that. And it took a little bit of getting used to. And if you don't know Spanish, then that presents sort of like a barrier of entry or barrier of access to the book. It's one that you can overcome. It's one that you can have, you can like have a Spanish English dictionary. You can still engage with the work, but it's also an intentional part of her writing. And it's a decision that she made in order to honor her identity, but also to then make folks who are engaging with this work in some small way experience maybe sort of the frustration or the types of obstacles that come with having to navigate between different cultures, different identities, different languages. So, you know, so I love how personal her writing is, but I also love how her writing, like she's a writer, she's an intellectual, she's a philosopher, but she's also an artist. And part of, and you see that she has in the book, there's some examples of some of her art, but her writing also is very much an art form.
It's so interesting to think about. And I think this is a little bit in the introduction, but I mean, she wrote this book over quite a span of time, wrote different chapters over quite a span of time. And I guess it's the last two or three chapters, she goes into second person. And then there's a whole section in that about I don't want it to be first person anymore because it centers me in a way that I really want to talk about what this means. And, you know, as a writer, I'm like, second person is hard. Like that is hard to pull off and not seem contrived. And yet she does it for three solid long chapters and it completely works. And it is that, like you said, that mix of Spanish. And then also just as a writer and her talking about, especially the chapter about actually writing, like it's just you reading it. I was like, oh man, this is me. I mean, not like the details, but just like the how you process your own artwork, whether that painting or writing, and like just the process of creating and destroying yourself and the work at the same time. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's sort of that's one of the main through lines right throughout the book is the constant interplay back and forth between like destruction and creation. And I mean, the book opens, I think the first chapter is called the Kolshakwi Imperative. And that whole pulling from the mythology about like the moon and how, you know, the waxing, the waning, the moon representative of like the dismemberment and rememberment of that particular lunar Aztec goddess. But then how she takes that core identity, that core mechanism, and then applies it over and over and over again to all of these different things, whether it's writing, whether it's identity, whether it's reality, whether it's, you know, what have you. And so she's applying it. It's like the super meta thing where she's like, here's this idea. I'm going to apply this idea to all these things. And in applying this idea to all these things, I'm going to destroy and rebuild and destroy and rebuild the idea itself. And so, yeah, it's just because for me, the chapter that really hit home for me was her chapter on identity and identity being performance and what it means to have an identity, what it means to have labels for identity. When do we choose labels? Like that for me, when I read it the first time was really impactful. And when I read it the second time, I had forgotten some of the stuff that was in there. Not the second time, I've come back to this book multiple times. When I read it for this, there's some stuff that I've forgotten there. And I've just been having some conversations with myself about identity. And it hit differently again. It's like, And I think from when I first read this book to reading it now and kind of where what I'm going through right now and some personal stuff in my life, it was this very, I had this very real bookend moment of just like, oh, wow. Like, yeah, like she's right. It is this constant construction and deconstruction, this constant, she calls it, she does cool things with words, how she writes them. It's like des/conocimiento. So like desconocimiento and conocimiento. So unknowing and knowing, you're forgetting it. And knowing. And so it's like, yeah, it is this constant interplay between remembering who you are, building yourself up, but then the unmaking of that and just how that's like a cyclical part of our lives that we don't hold a lot of space for.
Yeah, I was saying, when you were talking about the way she writes words and how that is so conceptual, like the no/otras thing. And I was thinking, like, even if you don't think of yourself as a marginalized identity, we all play to that. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, we all have these public, private personas. We all have us and other, you know, she's talking about in this very intersectional way around her identities. But it's so much more universal than that, which, you know, again, makes me angry when I think about how work like this gets compartmentalized or almost mm-hmm. ghettoized in academia.
Yeah.
When she's really speaking in a universal way too.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so it's important to name too that, especially when she's talking about that. So that no/otras, so like in Spanish, nosotras, nosotros, whatever. Like that's the word for us. And she takes that word, she breaks it down, she puts a slash between nos and otras. So it's nos, which also means us. It's sort of like I don't know the grammatical terms. But it's that, and then otra is other. So it's this idea between the interplay of we is the combination of us and others. But it's also important to remember that, like, a lot of her writing is informed by a lot of her marginalized, well, by her identities, many mm-hmm. marginalized, right. many with her identities that she had no choice in. She, you know, she's a woman of color, Chicana, you know, queer. So,
Disabled.
So identities that she had no control over, and also some identities that she had no control over, whether or not they were public. Mm-hmm. And you see that show up a lot in her writing and some of the examples that she gives. And for me, that, you know, that was that there were certain aspects that are resonant for me as a queer person, as a disabled person. But then there's also going to be some stuff that's not accessible to me because I'm not, you know, a assigned female of Earth. I'm not somebody who presents as a woman. I'm a white presenting person. So I'm not, you know, I don't navigate the world with what it's like to be somebody who has darker skin. So like she talks about, like, it's again, it's that nos otra thing she manages to pull off so well, where it's like, these are my experiences. These are experiences that are still informative for the way that you are, that some of the identities or experiences that you have too. But she does it in a way that is still asserting agency or reclaiming space as, you know, a queer disabled woman of color. Like, she's not giving that up in order to like make space for, you know, the majoritized sort of population. She's like, I think she's just a phenomenal philosopher and intellectual.
Yeah. And it's done so eloquently, and I can only imagine, like, how, based on what we know just from this book, how her writing process, it seems effortless, but I know it wasn't, you know, like that. And I think in the introduction it says she did not get her PhD from Santa Cruz, but they did actually award it to her posthumously, so technically she did have a doctor. But there's so much about this book, like just how personal it is. And just kind of her struggle with being alive and trying to create and fighting her own body while doing that. And, you know, these intersectional identities. And I don't know, I feel like I'm going to go back and read this book like two or three more times and see things I didn't see the first round. There's just so many layers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this was probably my second, maybe my third, like full read through again through the mm-hmm. book. But like, there are definitely parts of it that I go back to, or I incorporate a lot of this into some of the teaching and ministry that I do. So definitely parts that I go back to, sit with and kind of like get inspiration. But yeah, I would say, you know, the first time I read it, you know, talking about like her flowing between like English and Spanish so seamlessly, like that took a little bit of time for me to get used to. And so it wasn't really until like, I think the second time around that I read it again. But yeah, like I got more out of it because I came into a little bit more prepared. But also it's a book that because she wrote it, like it's a collection of essays. It's something that she, this book represents her writing over a pretty large span of time. And so I think depending on, you know, so she was navigating different experiences, different challenges, was being informed by, you know, lived experience that had accumulated, you know, depending on what part of the book that you're in. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that, depending on where you are in your own journey, that kind of lends like what part of the book resonates with you more.
Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah, that totally makes sense to me because I really did identify a lot with that section on writing just because where I am in my own work right now. It was almost hard to read in context. So it's just that, you know, you're thinking about your personal struggle. And that's one of the parts that's in second person. So it does have this, like, you're internalizing it as you're reading it kind of thing, which is something that well done second person can do. It's just really hard to pull off. And so I just, you know, while also reading it and struggling with these ideas about creation and creativity, and then also like just marveling at her writing at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, so I'm not a writer by trade. I think for me, what always stands out with her work is kind of getting back to the accessibility of it, right? Is mm-hmm. at the heart of what she's talking about, like whether it's identity or sort of the dissolution of like solid systems or structures and the frictions that's happening at the margins, whatever the things she's talking about are complex and heavy things, but she writes about them in such an effortless sort of prosaic way that it makes it accessible and you don't necessarily realize how deep she's taking you into a space until you're in there. And then you're like, oh, wow, wait a minute. Like, this is transformative, which I think is indicative of, again, a great philosopher, but also a great teacher, where she kind of tricks you almost into going into this like deeply critical self-reflective space that I think if it was written more academic, right, then I think a lot of people would chafe at her bucket and be like, that's not a thing that I want to engage with. I don't want to go with it right now. But she kind of spins you into it without realizing that that's where you're going.
It really makes me think about how she talks about El Cenote over and over again, like the, because mm-hmm. I think she could have said in English a well, but the well doesn't have the same connotation to me as a cenote because of how they were built, you know, and this really like digging down and being able to walk to the bottom of the well, like a cenote is so different than a well. And I was just like,
well, and also, sorry, I was going through my books. I thought that was one of the ones that bookmark, but it's not. But also like taking into the cultural context of the cenote too, of like mm-hmm. what the cenote means mm-hmm. as far as gateways to the underworld, what happened at the cenote, the offerings being made. So there's something also like if it was just a well, right, then there's something that's almost sanitized or sterilized right. about that. But being like, no, we're taking this deeply cultural, deeply spiritual symbolism, structure, location, metaphor, and that's what we're using because that's what all of this is. Like, you can't strip away, you can't sanitize it and just be like, yes, we're going to go deep into the well. Like, there's something functionally, metaphorically, and spiritually different and more impactful about engaging with a cenote that is representative of, like, you cannot talk about the cenote and strip it of its spiritual meaning, of its connection with the underworld, of its connection with death. Like, you cannot do that in the same way that mm-hmm. you can with a well.
Yeah, one of the things I marked and underlined in my copy was talking about, you know, the things, the offerings to the cenote, you know, like fruits and vegetables and virgins and your children, and what survives is then sacred and holy. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh, that, I had to stop and just sit with that for a while because I was like, that really is, and just such a good marker of how the way that she does transition between languages, like you said, is also the cultural transition and the philosophical transition and forcing you into that space with just something that seems as simple as using a different word. But it's there's so much encapsulated in that. Yeah, like I kind of am just at, like I said, as a writer, just in awe of her writing and just like you said, how effortless it seems, but how much work you're doing and not realizing it as you're reading.
Yeah. I also like to how her, you talk about her process, right? And you're just like, yeah, it seems effortless, but like, you know that this is something that is refined. Like there might be something sort of intuitive to it, but it's also something that has refined over the course of her life and her writing career. But I also love how you see her thought process, and she talks about this too, right? Like about like a visualized thought process in some of the art or some of the things, the images that are in the book are also images of like how she, the way that she has to contextualize her own thoughts to herself or her own philosophy to herself sometimes is in drawing. It's like drawings with notes around it. So like, even then it's not something that she can sort of verbalize initially. And so it shows that process of like, yeah, no, these didn't start as words. This was an idea. This was a thing that the only way she could express it at first was through her art and through vague notes that kind of, you know, the notes make sense once you read like the book and you go back to them and you're like, oh, okay, I see what's happening. But like that process of like, I don't know a lot of writers who their first draft of a book or something like that is them drawing out, sketching out what happens in the book necessarily. Yeah. So there's also her creative process is also this really interesting weaving between visual art or communicating, okay, what I'm thinking about, the first way I'm going to get it on paper is by drawing it out, and then I'm going to write about it because then I can write about the drawing because that will help me actually figure out how to talk about it.
Yeah, and I think especially there's so many of those in the book. And the first one, I was like, I kind of glossed over until I want to say she gets into more of it later because I didn't really, because the first read through, right? Like I got, like the drawing was like, okay, that's interesting. And then when she starts really talking about what she's doing, and then I went back and looked at them, and you're right. Like, it's like, oh, this is the outline of her theory.
Yeah,
And it's just, again, just remarkable. And just thinking about that process of visualization, then writing about it. And then she wrote in community in a way that I think a lot of writers don't. She really had, I mean, she talks about her writing comadre, that she has this whole group of people that she sends her work to and looks at their work. And thinking about that, like, that's a lot of time for one, like, you know, as a writer, like reading and cogently speaking on someone else's work takes time away from your own work, away from whatever else you're doing, you know, and to know that she wrote in this very open. And I think Annalise Keating talks about that in the opening too. Like she just like asked her, who was a student, to look at her work. And she's like, I don't, you know, that was so remarkable to me that she was just so open with like her process. Because a lot of writers do write in a black box and you only see like the finished, edited, published work, you know. I think it was that part was really interesting. And Anna Louise Keating honors that in the back of the book by including so much of like the alternate chapters and other stuff in the back that I didn't even get through all of that. But it's just like, you know, this book is so much about process too. Like as a writer, like I think this is an incredible book to read as a writer. In addition to like all of the other things you're going to get out of it, like it's just really, there's so many layers to go through.
That's really cool. I never thought about that. About again, like, you know, so I'm not written a book. Maybe that's on the horizon.
you have been writing though, and you've edited a book, which is a whole different process and work. Don't short sell yourself.
That's that. Okay. Thank you. But yeah, you know, when you were talking about her writing in community comadres and that, what came to mind for me was the one of the things that she talks about, one of the part of her philosophy is nipana, which is a Nahuatl word for sort of like the in-between space. I think the best way that we can contextualize it in English is sort of like liminal space, but it's so much more than that. Like it's also, it's liminal space, but it's the space where change happens. And I think, you know, to me, I think part of her process of being in community. So in addition to Nambanla, she talks about people who are Nepaleros and Nepaleras. So they are the people who not just find themselves in this space, in this in-between sort of change-making space where possibilities happen. There are people who actively go into that space because she talks about like ruptures happen. Mm-hmm. And it might be ruptures in your identity, it might be ruptures in society, it might be what have you, that fling people into this Nepali space. So we often find ourselves in, against our will. But people who are Nepaleros and Nepaleras, they're folks who go into that space willingly because that is the space where they understand that like progress happens, where change to create healing is possible. Mm-hmm. And then in doing that, they are the people who can help guide folks through that rupture, through that transition. And so I almost see her writing in community as stepping into that Nepalera sort of space of just like, we're working to build or to create something, you know, this book, this chapter, this essay, whatever we're working on together. The Bridge Called My Back was the collection of multiple writers that we're working together to step into this sort of breach to then create something that's going to come out on the other side. So to me, it's almost like her, not just like talking the talk of Nepantla and kind of being in that space, but also like walking it, of being like, mm-hmm. yeah. I'm stepping into the space and community to then model what it's like to then engage in this creative process. Because part of writing, you're right, like I have sent journal articles or whatever to folks. And, you know, like part of that process is having your stuff deconstructed and ripped mm-hmm. apart, and then yeah. you have to rebuild it. So some of it is having somebody to help navigate that space with you, or being community in that space.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, like, it's interesting when you said, you know, I'm not a writer, I'm not, and I was like, well, you know, I, before this, my knowledge of you is as the editor of a book that I contributed to. So I have, like, you know, my interaction with you as an editor, and like, I thought your notes back. So I don't think we mentioned this at any point. So Ron co-edited the most recent We Are Radia book, Serpents of Circe, with Laura yep. Tempest Sackroff. And so I submitted a piece, which is part of this bigger work that I'm working on. And your notes back were like, can you make this a little more succinct? And I was like, yes, I can do that. But it wasn't a critical thing. I mean, it was critical in like critique, but not critical and negative, whatever, you know. But I was like, oh, okay. And then just reading how you and Laura put the book together, like, and how it flows, and how, like, even though, like, the theme of the book was Circe, and that the idea of the serpent rising and resilience, you know, my piece is more, it is about resilience, but it's around Isis. And in the book, it just works itself in. Like, you guys did this fantastic job of just the flow of this book. And, you know, I think being an editor is kind of being in that Nepantla space, because you are creating something whole out of so many pieces. And this, especially because the pieces are short, it's a lot of work to kind of serialize, figure out where that goes. And I think editing kind of gets short shrift sometimes in the writing world. A, like any level of editing, because it's... writers need editors. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is like writers need editors, not just to get their book published, but to also, like, we all have these prosaic things we do. And I love that she talks about her literary vices, because we all have them as writers. And that's the work of an editor, is to see through that to the work. So I don't know. It's kind of fascinating to me to think about that all in context.
Well, when you frame it that way, of like the work of an editor is to like see through those vices, see through that to the work. I mean, that almost mirrors the language that she uses herself when she talks about sort of being in the Nepantla space and the role of the Nepantla sort of crossing that bridge. Is they see behind the facade, they see mm-hmm. behind what is happening to what is really happening, and they see sort of the cracks in things to actually then see, you know, what a possibility is. And so it's interesting that was the language that he chose to use in that instance, because that mirrors very closely like how she writes about the role of the Nepantla, like, no, they're the ones who can see behind what is being fed to us, like societally, to the larger scheme, to the larger picture that's happening.
So I was thinking, like, for listeners who haven't read the book or maybe even a little bit familiar with her work, like, what would you direct someone who read this book to next? Like, kind of in your philosophy of, like, okay, if you've read this, where do you go from here?
I think if you read this and, well, if you read this and you enjoyed it, This Bridge Called My Back is a great collection, and I highly recommend that one too. It has some of Gloria's stuff, but as mentioned in the intro, it's an edited collection of other essays, other pieces too. I think I also gravitate towards probably Audre Lorde. I think for me, there's a connection just thinking about the folks who kind of inform, like, my activism work. And so I think probably Audre Lorde. And then if you haven't read Pedagogy of the Oppressed, I always recommend people read Pedagogy of the Oppressed. I think those would be where I would direct people to.
So how, I guess, maybe I can frame this question the way I'm thinking it in my brain. I need to make a drawing, perhaps. So, like, I'm thinking about, like, in context, like, I think about, you know, like, a lot of books written kind of in this pagan spiritual space right now. It's very concrete. Like, here's a spell, here's a ritual, you know, and we're talking about things in kind of a bigger, around activist spirituality, but in kind of in spirituality in a bigger sense. So, like, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. It's like, I feel like there's a piece missing from, like, conversations in current pagan spaces about these bigger issues. I mean, I think it is happening around activism, but I still kind of feel like we're so fraught about talking about theology as pagans. So how do you think about that? Like, in context of Ndewi's work, of your work, of just, like, where we are in the evolution as a new religious movement?
Yeah.
Yes. That's a big question. Sorry. That's a big question.
No, it's fine. So it's a great question though. So you talked about sort of, like, current sort of pagan publishing, like the works that are happening are very sort of concrete, where it's like, here's the spell, here's the ritual, here's what have you. So in some ways I think it's kind of cookie cutter, or like copy paste, like plug and go, however you want to phrase it. And I think within the I think that's contrary, I think, to sort of, in this book at least, what Glenn Zaldúa was talking about, of the act of being in constant co-creation with yourself and your reality and your spirituality. I mean, literally, like, the subtitle of the book is rewriting identity, spirituality, and reality. And so I think, you know, for folks who are new to paganism, I think these books are great. Like, it's like, okay, here's various rituals, here's things you can try, because I think everybody needs a place to start from, where it's like, okay, this is how I do a thing. Or if you're being initiated into a particular tradition or path, learning how people do the thing, and becoming, you know, aware of it. You know, if one of the things that helps is when things become sort of, like, rote enough that you can be in the middle of doing your ritual or your ceremony or have you, and not have to pause and stop for a second and be like, wait, I need the book. I don't remember what I'm supposed to say next or where I'm supposed to go next. We've all been there. We all will be there again, because our brains are funny things. But so those are all great places to be. I think what happens, and I think why there's a certain, I'm going to use the word shallowness, and I don't mean it in the same way as sort of, like, vapidity or anything like that. So, like, nobody come for me for saying, like, paganism or paganism.
Do not come for Ron.
Yeah, there's a certain shallowness, I think, where we stop at that, and we don't get into this many of us, I should say, don't get into this deconstruction, reconstruction, co-creation process of our own spiritualities. We have, I think, a vehicle for it, or a space where we kind of acknowledge it a little bit. So in this is, I think, more so maybe in the last, like, 10, 15 years when I was growing up, I didn't hear this phrase too much, but the unverified personal gnosis, or UPG. So I think we have a space, or, like, a nascent space, where people can say, well, this is my reality. That's not, I don't want to say, like, my reality, but, like, this is my experience, or this is my what have you. So I think we're starting to carve out space for people to have that. But we don't have I would say in some ways we don't have the nepaneros, the nepaneras, like the people who can then help guide folks through, okay, well, what does that mean though? We have all these UPG experiences. How is this being tied into your worldview, into your practice? And I think also, you know, for a lot of us who are maybe coming from other religious backgrounds, other, for one reason or another, there might be trauma involved with that. There just might be distaste or dislike to like sort of an organizational structure. You know, the type of people who can kind of help facilitate those conversations of their experiences are folks who kind of step into a, not even a leadership role, but who maybe step into like a clergy type of role. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a need for being clergy, but I also understand that there's a knee-jerk reaction against, you know, trying to institutionalize or mirror other institutions. But I think that's part of the conversation we need to have around theology is like, just because we have a, you know, the word that we're using is clergy maybe, but just because we have that doesn't mean it has to look like something else. Mm-hmm. Part of that theology is how is your spirituality, your beliefs, like shaping your worldview and shaping your relationship? I also think, you know, a lot of what Gloria Anzaldúa talks about is relationship building or how we are in relationship and how different parts of ourselves at any given moment can be in friction, can be a source of friction for a relationship or a source of ease for a relationship, whether it's with the world or with ourselves or what have you. So, you know, I think there's just, we talk a lot about being in community in paganism, but I think we don't do a deeper dive into what does it mean to, what do relationships mean? What does relationship building mean? What does it mean to be in a relationship? And then we don't have that deeper conversation of how does my particular paganism, whether it's a particular tradition or something more personal, more eclectic, how is that informing my relationship to the world and how I build and cultivate that, both the seen and the unseen world, how I build and cultivate that.
And I think, you know, we are so atomized too. Like there's not, building community is difficult. I mean, like, I think, you know, I think 2 years ago now, gosh, time is a flat circle. Phoenix LaFay and I talked about Drawing Down the Moon and like how that early American paganism was so coven oriented, like, being a solitary witch kind of wasn't a thing. I mean, it was, obviously they existed, but it really was so focused on covens. And that's kind of the opposite place where we are now. Like, we're all solitaries to some extent, or, you know, especially since COVID, even like in the last 5 years, when things broke apart, we haven't coalesced again around a lot of those things. And so, like, I think community happens at places like, you know, conferences and things like that, which is a different kind of community because it coalesces for a moment and then breaks apart again. You know, it's not your constant small community. And I think that's one of the challenges around that of paganism or witchcraft or whatever, is that, you know, we don't have the parish church. You know, there's no central point in the community to come around as easily unless we create it. And that's quite difficult in a lot of instances. You know, we all have jobs and there is no clergy. I mean, there can be if you're in a coven, but even in coven situations, those people who might be in charge aren't necessarily trained. And I don't mean that in, like, you know, like in a hierarchical sense, but there is a gift and an art to being a counselor in a priesthood role or a priestly role. So because you can lead ritual doesn't automatically mean you can do that, I guess.
Exactly.
So I think it's, you know, I still feel like, you know, we're so in our infancy as a modern movement. And I think that pushback against, you know, hierarchy and organization. And I get that because so many people are walking away from mainstream religions with trauma from that very high control place. But I'm also like, we're selling ourselves short a little bit and not reclaiming this idea of priesthood for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It is a big question. You weren't wrong. I'm just, you know, I think about this a lot.
So. And I think, and I want to clarify to you, like, my response was meant to be critical in the sense of how you said before, like, you know, be critical, but in the sense of critique.
Right.
Because, yeah, we are a new movement. We are a new spiritual religious movement. We're also one that is, for the most part, like, pretty adaptive. Like, we're like, okay, we got to change. We got to do this. So So all the stuff that I pointed out or things that I pointed out is like issues or things that we need or things that I hope that we will continue to be in conversation about. Like, I'm not necessarily critical about like them not existing right now.
Yeah.
Because in some spaces they do, in some spaces they don't. But I think, you know, as our numbers grow, as you know, I think one of the first things we need to figure out how to do is how do we pass down and share knowledge, right? Because I'm about to turn 40, so I'm like, you know, wherever you want to place me, I'm like, whether that makes me old or young, paganism, I don't know. But there are a lot of folks who are leaders in that sort of first wave of paganism now, who are older or passing or have passed, but because we're not so great at planning ahead necessarily. Mm-hmm. That we don't have, well, what is the succession plan? How is this particular, how is this knowledge going to be shared and disseminated? How this particular circle or this organization or have you, how it runs? How is it going to continue post X person?
Yeah.
And how are the people who are going to lead it being trained to take up leadership in that? We've seen, you know, I'm not going to name names, or whatever, but we've seen, you know, a handful of work of conferences or organizations just kind of dissolve because the person who it was one, maybe two people that kept it going. And then when they passed, it's gone now. So now there's the void. There's a void in that space, spiritually, but also in some real instances, geographically, because it might have been the only thing that happened in like a three-state area. You know, I think there's got to be a lot of that conversation about we're at a point now where our elders are doing the thing that elders do. They move on.
Mm-hmm.
And how are we accommodating for that? How are we planning for that? And then also to your point too about like just because you're a good like coven leader or ritual leader doesn't mean you're a great counselor. Also too, just because you might be a clergy member or something. So I'm ordained pagan clergy to take a congregation. I refer to myself as a hedge priest because I don't have a particular sort of place in which my ministry resides. It, mm-hmm. it resides where I wander around.
Yeah.
But I am not a mental health counselor. So I can help folks in a certain capacity. I can do certain things, but also part of my responsibility is to know where my limits are and know when it is my responsibility to then say, okay, you need a level of service or access to a service that I can't provide, but I will help you find that service. And then understanding that, you know, part of that is then, okay, I'm not a mental health counselor. And what you need right now is that. So let me have to work with you to find somebody who is pagan affirming or queer or whatever the situation might be to do that. So I also think we have a lot of training to do, I think, around sort of leadership. I've actually been playing around with this idea about, and there's an essay or my writer, a video essay I might do on my Patreon or something, I'm not sure, around this notion of sovereignty, because I keep, for whatever reason, I've heard that term pop up a lot in the last couple of weeks.
I have some ideas about why, but.
what I keep not seeing in the conversations that I kind of just kind of lurking on, just being like, what's going on, is that, you know, people want to talk about sovereignty as far as the sort of just like autonomy or agency onto myself. But sovereignty also comes with it historically a certain like an implicit amount of responsibility that you have to, you know, in the older times, you know, right, like sovereign of the land, there was a relationship with the land. So they were sovereign because of their relationship with the land. The land acknowledged them as sovereign. And with that came certain responsibilities to the land and its people. You know, to be sovereign, I think today also means, well, you can't just do whatever you want, whenever you want, and be like an ass about it. You have the ability to have that level of agency or autonomy, but then with that comes a responsibility to how is that manifesting around you? How are you being in relationship with people around you? So I think part of that too is, you know, we have a lot of folks who want to be leaders, find themselves in leaders, leadership positions, but then there's not a critical awareness of what type of responsibility comes with being in that position.
Well, and I think we still have this very Western idea of hierarchy. And yep. I think, you know, when I think about like paganism and witchcraft, I think in a much more anarchist plane. And I think it's difficult. I mean, I'm in my 50s, So like, I think about that leadership position is like, I don't feel comfortable in that role as a leader, but then I also realize that it's kind of a responsibility to step up as well and to share knowledge, especially. And so much of that has happened in pagan and witchcraft spaces through books, which are not accessible to everyone. And, you know, so how do we create that space where people can step into an elder role? Listeners can't see my scare quotes because I have a lot of feels about that. But, you know, how can we step into those spaces with that understanding that this is not hierarchical? This is just, you know, more anarchist way of looking at like skill sharing or knowledge sharing, you know, like that kind of way of looking at it. And I mean, in my tradition, we have these things called passion craft sessions where someone who's just, you know, like nerded out about something just shares that. And,
I love that so much.
You know, like it is very much like an anarchist skill share kind of thing, you know, and I'm like, how do we build on this? You know, how do we look at things like mutual aid and anarchy and include that if we don't want to step into that hierarchical, you know, high control situation of mainstream religions that we've supposedly left, you know, like, yeah, clearly there's a lot, clearly there's a lot to think on and do, but I know you and I are not the only two people having this conversation, which is very heartening.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, I feel paganism is like the perfect place to really lean into. Like, if folks are looking for like, okay, we want it, because of trauma or whatever reason, like we don't want to replicate sort of institutional frameworks and stuff like that. I think paganism is a perfect place right now to lean into frameworks of like mutual aid, things like that. Like, so I'm really glad that you named that. Because I think for a lot of what I hear folks are wanting out of that type of community, you know, I engage in a lot of mutual aid stuff. So I'm just like, what you want is mutual aid. Like, what you want is what you want is this sort of type of setup. And I'm thinking about, there's a book called The Pagan Leadership Anthology. And there's a essay in there, multiple essays from folks who were pagan leaders of various stripes. But one of them, I forgot the name, but it's about how like guacamole almost ruined their coven. And it was a thing where they became sort of the coven leader, and just the stress of feeling they had to plan everything on their own, of organize everything on their own, you know, other people weren't stepping up, but this person felt like as a leader or just to maintain, like not have friction in the group, they couldn't like call people out or call people in or what have you. And it all manifested where like it all came to a head where at a coven gathering, someone didn't like the type of guacamole that they had thought. And they like lost their mind, like the coven leader lost their mind and realized afterwards, be like, this was because I let it get to this point where I didn't tell people that I needed help, where I didn't tell people that being in community meant that there were certain expectations. Like, I'm working full time. I'm also, if we want to be in this community, we have to kind of be in, like, we all have to take responsibility for like who can step in and do what part. And it ended up being an overall good experience because then like post that, they're like, okay, so like there's a different person in the coven that rotates of like who's responsible for the snacks, like who's going to do this. So like the workload is shared amongst the community after that.
Yeah, and I think that is why a lot of people are reluctant to step into leadership roles of any kind, because it's like, it's, you know, and having been a UU for a long time, it's like once you say yes to being on a committee, they'll ask you every time. And so a lot of people step back. And it's like, you can't burn out the people who are willing to give their time. And you know, that it's a lesson I think a lot of organizations have to learn, and non-organized organizations have to learn too. It's the same people can't step up all the time. Right. Like it doesn't foster succession. It doesn't, you know, like there's so many problems around it in addition to just burning those people out.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, yeah, there's just a lot to think on and ponder. And I love it. Like this book, like it feels like there's a part where she's talking about being on the train and holding onto the pole and all of the other strangers holding onto the pole. And that's, you know, this new organism of like, and that's what we should look at. And I was like, oh, you know, it's just those little moments where I'm like, okay, yes. It spark like 10,000 other things that come off of that. So,
well, that's, I think one of the things I love about this book too, is that it this might sound like a weird way of phrasing it, but it's the only way I can phrase it. But like, it gives permission for change. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And so like, yeah, like, again, thinking about like, what type of structures, community structures do we want to build in paganism, right? Like, read this book. Like think about what does it look like to step out as far away from center as possible. Is that center is that she talks about center being that sort of like solidified structure where nothing shifts, nothing changes. So, you know, what does it look like to step as far away from center as possible and think about something different? She talks about dreaming new realities and leaning into the dreams. Something's when you, I can't remember how she phrased it, but like, yeah, I mean, that's, we've heard that from multiple, you know, philosophers, civil rights leaders and stuff like that. Like, you have to dream of something else and then lean into it and like live as if that dream was reality. And that's part of what she talks about is dreaming a different reality and then living it like into existence.
Yeah. And she talks about it in that big way. And then also in like in her small way of dealing with her diabetes. Yeah. Like it's like it's microcosm and macrocosm at the same time.
Yeah. Very, you know, the hermetic as above, so below.
Yeah. No, I love that. So I would love to talk to you about this book for like another 3 hours, but I know that we both have deadlines. So I wanted to end on her words. So I did ask Ron before I put him on the spot, just for listeners, please don't think I just like completely called out my guest. So Ron is going to read a section. There's a ritual at the end of the book, which I love that her dissertation ends with a ritual. And Ron's going to read part of that and kind of give you some context for it.
Yeah. So the ritual is something she calls the ritual prayer blessing for transformation. And it's, you know, a couple of pages long. And she does, you know, it involves casting a circle, facing the directions, facing the sky. I'm going to read the part where after completing the circle, you return to the center. And you are looking down and calling into the underworld. A lot of my work is with ancestor veneration, ancestor work. So this felt like the appropriate part for me to read. So may the roaring force of our collective creativity heal the wounds of hate, ignorance, indifference, dissolve the divisions creating chasms between us, open our throats so we who fear speaking out raise our voices. By our witnessing, find connections through our passions, pay homage to those whose backs served as bridges. We remember our dead. Pat Parker, Audre Lorde, Tony Kade Bambara, Barbara Cameron, y tantas otras.
Thank you. Ron, thank you so much for picking this book and introducing me to her work. I really just, that was a gift and I really appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks for your time.
Yeah, no, I literally pushed this book on everybody. So this was great.
Great. And, you know, is there anything you want to plug here at the end for folks? This will air in mid-May or mid-April.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So mid-April. Okay. Yeah. So mid-April. So I think the thing I want to plug is I just recently launched a Patreon. So you can find me at Patreon at White Rose Witching, or you can go to my website, whiterosewitching.com, and there's a link to the Patreon up top. There's multiple sort of ways to engage, different membership levels to engage, but your support helps me to move into like the next phase of this project of doing deeper dives into queer history and queer ancestors, spiritual activism, and pagan theology. As I mentioned at the beginning, specifically liberation theology through a pagan lens. And a Patreon exclusive is bone casting. So that's something I've been practicing for several years. And so at the $5 up level, you get access to a monthly bone casting where I kind of at the beginning of the month do a casting for, you know, what's coming down the pipe. But at the top tier, you get access to me for a quarterly one-on-one bone casting that we can either do live via video, or I can do it, you know, separately and then send you the video or send you a write-up of it. But, and the top spots are limited just because I do have other things that I'm doing, so I can't just constantly be doing bone casting.
You are a finite person. As I would love to. Your time is finite.
Yeah. Awesome. But yeah, so any support on Patreon is very, very greatly appreciated. And you also, through the Patreon, you'll get access to my newsletter and other, you know, so you can get other updates about where I'm at, what I'm doing. And also I do a monthly newsletter that is at the end of the month. I only send it out once a month. I don't like getting spam. I don't want to spam you. And it's just a roundup of blog posts, announcements, upcoming events, things like that.
And there'll be links to all that. And I will try and put links to bookshop.org for all the books we talked about, too, in addition to this one, if people want to dive in more. And I'll have links to your social media that isn't Meta on there as well.
So I'm on Blue Sky. So you can find me on Blue Sky.
I'll find you on Blue Sky. Great. And
Just a heads up that the Blue Sky stuff is less witchy stuff and more me screaming about politics. Which, if that's what you're into, follow me on Blue Sky. I mean,
it has its own witchiness about it. Putting that power out into the universe, if nothing else. Awesome. Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenetkar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram or Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. And thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.